General Rich, Siege of Kut, Reel 2.
When you look back on it now, what, 60 years after, what's your main impression?
Main impression of what, please?
Well, when you look back now, 60 years after the Siege of Kut, what's your main memory of that particular part of your life?
An interlude. An unpleasant interlude, to put it like that. But that's about all. I never looked back awfully much. I looked forward. And so I forgot it. I was very glad to see when I met the men again, when we'd all got back to India some months later. But there it was, finished.
What was it, do you think, that pulled you through that particular part of your life?
Youth, chiefly. Something to do. For instance, I mended shoes as a prisoner, which gave me some occupation. I even went so far as to get some military books from home, old campaigns, and I started to learn to be a soldier.
When you say shoes, whose shoes did you mend?
Who are the officers in the camp? You could buy nothing in Turkey, and so we had to do what we'd done. We found a soldier in the Norfolks who'd been a snob, that's what they call a cobbler, and he put us on the right lines, and we made a little firm of four of us, and we mended people's shoes. And we mended them quite well, I may say, too, because everything was hand-sewn. That, and... Well, one's always looking or thinking about trying to get away. And after the three officers had got away from Castamoni, which was our first camp, we were all eventually moved to a place called Yozgat. And there we had a mass walkout one night, of which eight officers got right away and the other 13, 17 were dragged back ignominiously at different times.
We go back to the cobbling, the mending of shoes. Have you ever cobbled or mended a pair of shoes since those days as a POW?
Not really, no. I could always find someone to do it for me.
You've never felt the urge to pick up a hammer and a mouthful of nails?
Not quite. We hand-sewed everything. Very few nails were used in our shoe.
Can I ask you, have you ever been back to Kut or to Baghdad?
About 1921, I was suddenly hoisted away from my regiment to join another, which was on its way to Baghdad. And I went back with that. I regret to state the general took one look at the regiment and sent it home. It was quite beyond anything I'd ever seen. And I got a staff job there, and I spent a year there.
Did it live up to its expectations, Baghdad?
Oh, Baghdad was quite pleasant. Very hot in the hot weather, stinkingly hot. But the cold weather, you could go and do a bit of duck shooting, and was always riding in the mornings, and the work wasn't very strenuous.
There are 41 known survivors from the Siege of Kut. You have reunions from time to time. What do you talk about?
I think they mostly start, "Do you remember?" And we'll get a lot of old soldiers together. That's what they talk about. What happened to so-and-so, that sort of thing. Purely reminiscence and nothing else.
And when you start, what do you remember?
I don't know. It depends who I'm talking to. I mean, I've got a lot of pals. In fact, they're all my pals, soldiers or officers, doesn't matter who they are. We were always in all ranks. The times we had our regimental dinners, we were always all ranks. And we were all pals together. We try to have, you can't avoid having rank, but we try to avoid it as much as possible. We did. And so we shall on the 26th.
How much did friendship play a part in your life in the Siege of Kut? Was there somebody there who you really couldn't have got through without them?
There was probably one officer. He was the adjutant when I joined 3 years before. And he, and I must add, Subedar Major Kitab Gul, who was our senior officer, and senior Indian officer, and who took a liking to me. And those two really shaped my military career from the words go. I must own that when I met the adjutant on Belgaum Station, when I arrived, feeling very ill, actually, his first remark was, "I've got a polo pony for you." Well, I never played polo, and I wasn't interested in anything except getting to bed then. But he was a very great influence, someone I've been very grateful to all my life. And then this wonderful Indian officer.
What was the one lesson you think that you learnt from those two gentlemen?
I think, if you ask me, you've tied me down to one. I should say the answer is never ask anyone to do what you can't and won't do yourself.
And how did that manifest itself in Kut?
Well, because there we were, you were with them, you were with the men. If anyone wanted to do on the sticky job, well, you went there too. That's all. I mean, it's just some people can sit back and say, "Go and do that." Well, I couldn't. It wasn't our regimental custom to go and sit back. If there was something to be done, come along, come and do it with me. That sort of idea. But that is regimental spirit, which is, you get the same story from every unit you talk to.
Do you think regimental spirit got you through Kut?
It certainly helped. We only could let the blighters know we were frightened of them or anything else like that.
Were you frightened of them?
Of course we were. Can't go to war without being frightened.
What was your view of the Turks at this time? They had a very bad reputation as fighters, didn't they?
Again, I put the Turks into two categories. Their officers, who were really the scum of the earth, and the Turkish peasant, who was a soldier. Own he was uncivilized, and by our standards, brutal, but I think, or thought then anyhow, under good officers, you couldn't have got a better soldier anywhere. They lived on nothing, they was hard as hell. And I had a great respect and admiration for the Turkish soldier and the Turkish villager. But bring me an officer, nothing to do with them at all.
They didn't have the military background and breeding
of
an English officer.
I mean, you will find people, you will talk, well, I talked about the brutalities of the Turks, but it was only the treatment they showed to their own men. The officers had the power of life and death without any question, and there was nothing to the usual form of discipline was to slap a man in the face. And if they had no hesitation in shooting a man out of hand. And so the men were nothing to the officers, and they treated our men just the same. Actually, there's no word for prisoner of war in Turkish at all. There wasn't any, just a slave. And a slave has no rights at all, not even those of life.
I'll ask the question. Was any attempt ever made to try to break the blockade in any way?
Well, right towards the end, the army commander down below suggested to the Royal Navy, the admiral commanding the East India Station was up there at the moment, they should try and break the blockade and take a month's rations into Kut, at the lower scale. And the admiral never thought much of it, but he said, "If someone will assure me that this attempt will not just prolong the agony, but be some real, give Kut a real chance." And somebody did. And very reluctantly, he said the word go. So they took the best of the commercial river steamers on the Tigris, the Jalna, which was a screw steamer instead of paddle, and had her screws in tunnels, which prevent with prevented snags hitting the river. She could take about a month's rations. She was armoured round the small bridge, and the rations were built up to help defend her. The whole of the Royal Navy in Mesopotamia volunteered to go in her. They took one naval lieutenant as captain. They took the engineer of the Jalna, who was Royal Naval Reserve, and they took, very reluctantly, a Captain Cowley, who was the senior pilot in the company and had been on the river for 33 years, so much so that the Turks considered that he was a Turkish subject and had put £1,000 on his head. Well, he was told all this, but he said, no, I'm about the only person who can get it through, and I'll go. And of course, conditions were terrible. It had to be by night. They had to go through 20 miles of Turkish positions in a raging torrent, and it really was a stout effort. They got through to within 8 miles of Kut, right past the last Turkish position, when they were held up by a ferry cable. And just about that time, a shell hit the bridge, killed Furman, who was the lieutenant, naval lieutenant in command, wounded Cowley, and the ship got onto the bank and they couldn't get her off again. And when the Turks took her over, they took Cowley away and he was never heard of again. We all think he was just shot out of hand because they considered him a Turkish subject. The crew, which would have been 12, were all, and the engineer, were taken prisoners. I got in touch quite recently with the sole survivor of the Jalna, and he gave me a lot of local colour. He was in the bow the whole time, the ship said, and I got a lot of local colour out of him. But it really was a most gallant attempt.
What was his story, the sole survivor? What did he have to say about
it? Oh, very little, really. He was in the bow, and he just talked about the shot and shell, which they had all the way. He remembers when the ship was held up, that a cable caught in the bow of the ship. He and the other man there tried to get an explosive charge onto it, but either the cable broke or it slipped under the ship. And at that moment, another one whizzed over his head and got entangled with the rations and armour plating, and that was the end. And he said when he got on shore, they were given cups of tea by the Turks, who said, "You're very brave men, but you're complete fools. We knew you were coming 48 hours ago."